Welcome back. We left off the last lecture with Alexander having successfully carried out Philip's plan to invade the Western Persian Empire. From this point on, Alexander will no longer be following in the footsteps of Philip, but instead carving out his own path. Let's see where this leads him. The Persian King of Kings, Darius III, alarmed by Alexander's victory at the Granicus, had himself determined to take the field against Alexander, and he marched out with his army. After some initial maneuvering around mountain passes, the two armies came together on the plain of Issus in November of 333 BC. Alexander placed his Sarissa-armed phalanx in the center with his cavalry units to either side. Now, Alexander was outnumbered, but he once again attacked aggressively despite this. And the turning point of the battle occurred when Alexander launched his cavalry directly at Darius, who was in the center of the Persian lines. Frightened by the ferocity of the Macedonian charge, Darius turns around, runs off, abandons his army, and fled as quickly as possible to the rear. The Persian army, somewhat understandably dismayed by their king's flight, was thoroughly routed. Alexander also captured the Persian baggage train, which included not only Darius's tent and his personal belongings, but also Darius's wife, his children, and even Darius's mother. Darius himself, though, escaped. After the crushing defeat at Issus, Darius attempted to limit his losses by sending to Alexander a letter in which he offered a peace treaty and an alliance, if only Alexander would march no further and give back Darius's family. Alexander's reply to this proposal survives, and I think it reveals a lot about how Alexander saw himself and how he was beginning to view his goals. Up until this point, the expedition had officially been presented as simply seeking revenge for Persia's earlier invasions of Greece. And it probably, up to this point, had very limited goals of capturing some territory and gaining some treasure. But as Alexander's successes mounted one after the other, it seems that his ego and his ambitions also appear to have grown. So when he gets this letter, all of his advisors urge him, accept the terms. You've already accomplished more than anybody else thought possible. But in his reply, Alexander not only rejects Darius's offer, but he answers him in a taunting tone. And he concludes this letter by announcing his intent to supplant Darius as the king of Persia. Let me read you this. Alexander says, "From now on, approach me as the Lord of all Asia. In future, whenever you communicate with me, send to me as the king of Asia. Do not write to me as an equal. If you wish to lay claims to the title of King of Kings, then stand your ground and fight for it. But do not run away, as I shall chase you wherever you may go." This proud, really arrogant rejection of Darius's overtures indicates that Alexander would now be satisfied with nothing less than the complete subjugation of Persia. Well, at this point, Alexander might have been expected to pursue Darius into the heart of the Persian Empire. But instead of chasing Darius, Alexander instead turns south and goes along the coast of the Mediterranean. And this is actually a very sound strategic move. The big, powerful Persian fleet still controlled the Mediterranean Sea. And if Alexander had simply marched into Asia, that fleet behind him would have threatened his supply lines, and they could have incited rebellion back in Greece. So Alexander had to destroy the fleet before he could continue his pursuit of Darius. Now, this presented a major problem, because Alexander had no effective fleet of his own to match up against that powerful Persian navy. How can you defeat a navy if you don't have one? Well, Alexander found a way. His clever strategy was not to even try to challenge the Persian fleet at sea, but instead to overcome it by capturing all of their bases along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. So, Alexander devised a way to defeat a naval power using just a land army. And the most important of all the naval bases was a city called Tyre in Phoenicia. And for about a year, Alexander conducted siege operations against it. Tyre was located on an island just offshore, and so it was inaccessible from the mainland without crossing that intervening strait of water. So the challenge here was how to get across that strait of water without any ships. Well, again, Alexander's solution was simple, brilliant, if somewhat labor-intensive. He had his men build an enormous causeway out to the city, and he literally connected Tyre to the mainland. Once this was accomplished, he could simply march his army right up to the walls, and so Tyre was captured and the survivors sold into slavery. The other Persian naval bases soon fell to Alexander as well. And so, having conquered the Persian fleet, he then keeps going along the coast to Egypt. And there, he founded a city at the mouth of the Nile River, which, long term, would prove to be one of his most lasting and important accomplishments. And, not very modestly, he of course named that city Alexandria. And it will become one of the largest, most significant in the ancient Mediterranean. Another notable event occurred during Alexander's stay in Egypt. Alexander visited an oracle, the oracle of the god Zeus Ammon, which was located far out of his way, deep in the Libyan desert, at an oasis called Siwa. And the ancient sources disagree with one another over what questions Alexander asked the oracle, but he seemed pleased at the response he got. And rumors circulated that when he entered the temple, the priest hailed him as the son of the god. Now, Alexander also claimed descent from the hero Hercules. And coins of Alexander frequently show Alexander wearing the lion skin headdress of Hercules. Now, whether or not Alexander himself believed in this various divine ancestries, we're not entirely sure. But at the very least, his ego seems to have notched up another level after this visit. Well, Alexander was now free to resume his pursuit of Darius. So he crossed the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, and he marched into Mesopotamia late in 331 BC. Darius, though, had not been idle. He knew that there would have to be a final and decisive showdown with Alexander. And Darius was determined to bring the full weight, wealth, and power of all the great Persian Empire against this young upstart. And ever since that disaster at Issus, Darius had been gathering together the military resources of the Persian Empire, and he had amassed a huge army composed of over 20 different ethnic groups. And ancient sources give fantastically large numbers for the size of Darius's army, but whatever the number was, it certainly outnumbered Alexander's several times over. Darius's very best forces were thousands of skilled cavalrymen. But he also prepared a special secret weapon for the upcoming battle. He took several hundred chariots, and he had sword blades attached to their wheels, so when they spun around, hopefully they would chop up Alexander's phalanx. And finally, to be sure that Alexander couldn't use any trick relating to the terrain, Darius carefully selected a location for the battle. And this was a vast, perfectly flat plain called Gaugamela. And here he hoped he could use his chariots to best effect, and here he planned on using his superior numbers to surround and overwhelm Alexander's army. Darius then simply sat down at his chosen site with his mighty army and waited for Alexander to come into his trap. In all of his previous battles, Alexander had always attacked at once. But when he comes to Gaugamela and is confronted by this enormous force, Alexander camps for the night to rest his troops, scout out the terrain, and plan his strategy. And according to our sources, he went to bed, slept soundly, despite the fact that the very next day would see the final battle to determine who would be the King of Kings. Gaugamela was really Alexander's finest battle. And I won't go through all the details, but first he managed to neutralize those scythe chariots by opening up lanes in his trained phalanx so that the chariots just sort of swept harmlessly through, and then they were overwhelmed with Alexander's light troops. So that the Persians couldn't surround him, he cleverly arranged his forces in a box shape. But even with all of his brilliance, as the battle dragged on, those overwhelming Persian numbers began to take their toll. And a crack opened in the Macedonian phalanx. At this crucial moment, Alexander once again personally jumped on his horse and led a charge of the companion cavalry straight across the battlefield at Darius in his chariot. Darius was protected by tens of thousands of his best cavalry, so he was never in any real danger. But when he saw Alexander storming across the battlefield right at him, you can guess what happened. He lost his nerve, got scared, turned his chariot around, and abandoned his army. Demoralized by the cowardice of their king, the Persians were defeated. Alexander was now King of Kings of Persia. Alexander would spend a couple more years mopping up little pockets of resistance and chasing Darius around the mountains, and Darius eventually just dies on the run. After Gaugamela, the Persian Empire effectively belonged to Alexander. Alexander goes on to capture all the royal cities of Persia, Susa, Babylon, and Persepolis. And at Persepolis, he seized the royal treasury, which was said to contain more than 120,000 talents of gold. Now, a talent weighs a little bit more than 50 pounds, so you can do the math if you want. But basically, Alexander and every one of his men had acquired the greatest treasure of the ancient world, and all of them, overnight, were fabulously wealthy. In a unfortunate incident, during the victory celebration, the wonderful city of Persepolis was burnt to the ground. And whether or not Alexander intended to do this, we don't know. Some sources say that the drinking party just got out of hand, while others say that Persepolis was intentionally burnt as revenge for the sack of Athens in 480 BC. Even with all this, Alexander was still not content. He then marched north up to the Caspian Sea, east to the mountains of Bactria and Sogdiana, that's today modern Iran and Afghanistan, and he heads off into Central Asia. He then turns south, and in another incredible feat, by now becoming standard, he crosses the Hindu Kush and descends into what today is Pakistan and northwest India. So basically, he had conquered the entire known world, and now he's simply heading off with his army into the unknown to see what else he can find and conquer. In 326 BC, at the river Hydaspes in northern India, he fought the last of his four great battles. And this was against the local ruler, an Indian Raja named Porus. And at this battle, Alexander faced all new challenges, including having to cross a river in flood, and having to deal with a totally new type of weapon that he had never seen before, war elephants. But All that proved to be no problem. Once again, Alexander is victorious. During the course of his march, Alexander found many more cities, and he used these sometimes to settle some of his aging veterans. And over a dozen of these, he named, again, not very modestly, Alexandria. So there's Alexandria scattered all over Asia. And after that victory in India, he seems to have had a burst of originality, so that he named his next two cities Nicaea, which means victory town, and Bucephala, which was the name of his beloved horse Bucephalus, which had just died. Those cities were thoroughly Greek in plan, and they were equipped with all the typical Greek buildings that we would find back in Greece. So long after other effects of his conquest had disappeared, those cities remained, and each one acted as a little local disseminator of Greek culture. And really, in the long run, it's this spreading of Greek culture that was the most significant effect of his campaigns. If not for Alexander dispersing Greek culture all over the then-known world, it might just have stayed a relatively unimportant local civilization. Then in India, he faced a crisis from a new direction. At the river Hyphasis, Alexander's own army mutinied, and they refused to march any further. They, what I think very reasonably argued, is that they had earned enough glory, they had plenty of wealth, they now simply wanted to go home and enjoy it. Alexander flew into a rage, and he sulked in his tent for 3 days. But the troops wouldn't give any ground, they were adamant, and so Alexander was forced to turn back. And one of the great ironies of Alexander's life is that he was never defeated in battle, but his dreams of conquest were ultimately curbed by his own army. Well, marching back took about 2 years. So he marched back to Babylon, and this time he took a southern route along the coast of the Arabian Sea so he could conquer some new things, and he conquered all those territories that he passed through. His army also endured a truly horrible march across a desert, during which a large part of it died, and Alexander himself suffered a near-fatal wound while attacking a small hilltop town. This particular incident, I think, is revealing both about Alexander's leadership and his occasional tendency towards rashness. During the siege of this little city, he became annoyed that his men were not pressing the attack with enough enthusiasm. So he jumped up, scaled the enemy wall himself, and then foolishly jumped down alone into the enemy town. By the time his horrified soldiers could get in there and rescue him, he had been wounded several times, including an arrow that pierced his chest cavity. Miraculously, he recovered, but this sort of injury cannot have strengthened his overall health. Eventually, Alexander arrived back to Babylon and began plans for a new campaign against Arabia. But after an all-night drinking binge with his buddies, he fell ill with a fever, which got steadily and steadily worse until after about 2 weeks, he died. And at the time of his death, he was just 33 years old. All right, that's the basic outline of his life. What I want to do now is to consider some of the specific problems that he faced and how he dealt with those. And one recurrent issue was the tension created by his multiple roles. So, to the Macedonians, he was their king and their general. To the Greeks, he was the leader of a joint expedition. But to the conquered Persians, he was the king of kings, a remote, absolute, and godlike figure. Compounding this multiplicity of identities was all the variety of cultures which he had come to represent. So again, technically, he was a Macedonian, a barbarian by Greek standards. But he presented himself as a Greek and was an enthusiastic champion of Greek culture. And finally, after his conquest, he began to adopt some Persian customs, including dressing in Persian clothing. Alexander also faced the problem of how to rule such a huge and culturally disparate empire. There simply weren't enough Macedonians to garrison this whole thing. So his solution was to try to combine the Macedonians and the Persians. He founded cities whose population was a mixture of Greek, Macedonian, and Persian, and he tried to integrate Persian units into the army. So he reformed even the phalanx so that it had both Macedonian and Persian troops, each one armed with their usual national weapons. He also enlisted many Persian cavalry units, and he even admitted some Persian noblemen into the elite companion cavalry itself. One of his boldest steps was to actively encourage marriages between Macedonians and Persians. So he himself had married Roxanne, a Bactrian princess, and then at Susa in 324 at a mass marriage ceremony, which was conducted in the Persian manner, he married a daughter of Darius, and he wed 80 of his companions to the daughters of Persian nobles. He also gave gifts to 10,000 of his soldiers who had taken Asian wives. And he took this whole experiment in social engineering even further by arranging for 30,000 Persian boys to be taught Greek and to be trained in Macedonian military tactics. And it's been argued by some that Alexander had a grand vision of creating not only a single political empire, but a single universal culture that would combine together what he saw as the best aspects of all different cultures. Some scholars see this as a noble vision that stressed toleration and inclusiveness, but others see him as an imperialistic and power-mad destroyer of local cultures. His policy of social integration ended up creating some serious problems, and this was especially the case with the Macedonians, who considered themselves conquerors, who deserved to lord it over all the people that they had subdued. And they deeply resented the privileges that had been given to the Persians. In particular, the assignment of Persians to important positions in the Macedonian army caused a lot of resentment among Alexander's veterans. During another near mutiny, the army cited among their grievances that Alexander had enlisted Persians into the army, that he dressed like a Persian, and that he had granted other Persians favors that he didn't even give to the Macedonians. Another source of tension between Alexander and the Macedonians arose from a Persian custom called proskynesis. And this was the standard practice of prostrating yourself before the King of Kings. Now, in Macedon, you only prostrated yourself before the gods. And so to do so before Alexander would be to worship him as if he were a god. And after an attempt to introduce this custom among the Macedonians, they reacted with enormous hostility towards this. They said, no, you're a man, not a god. Alexander had to just drop it. Alexander's scheme to combine Macedonians and Persians in the end was unsuccessful. His spreading of Greek culture, on the other hand, was much more lasting, especially around the Mediterranean portion of his empire. Although some Greek influences persisted even as far away as India. One of the major weaknesses of his achievements was that really his empire was held together by personal ties to himself. Before he died, he failed to appoint a clear successor, and so this ensured that his empire immediately broke apart. And we don't know what his long-term plans would have been. Some ancient sources give these grandiose schemes for future campaigns and projects, They mention things like conquering the Western Mediterranean, going after Carthage and Rome, subjugating all of Europe, Arabia, and the Black Sea region, and building lavish temples and monuments, including a pyramid that would be as big as those in Egypt, which would mark the grave of Philip. Now, whether or not Alexander really intended to do any of those things, none of them get carried out by his successors. And it's entirely possible that Alexander had no long-term strategy other than to just sort of keep conquering until he ran out of enemies. At least as a general, no one can deny Alexander's genius. At both the tactical and the strategic levels, he was consistently successful. He won 4 great set battles, a number of important sieges, and innumerable skirmishes. And he did this by combining very careful preparation before battle with decisive boldness when actually in combat. And in the end, maybe one of his most lasting but kind of dubious achievements was that he inspired a number of generations of later would-be conquerors who all attempted to emulate him, just as he had attempted to emulate Achilles, his hero. With Alexander, the separate worlds of the Mediterranean, the Near East, and at least some of India briefly became one. Now, his united political empire doesn't survive his death, but his actions did link together these widespread civilizations more closely, and they helped to establish trade routes and routes of communication that would not be forgotten, even after he was gone. Except at the earliest stages of their histories, these regions had never truly been totally isolated. But from this point on, ideas and products routinely traveled back and forth among them. And so, I guess in that respect at least, Alexander did achieve a universal empire. We've now surveyed the first 2 of our 5 great men. And having heard the biography of Alexander, you can now assess for yourself how much you think Alexander's accomplishments stemmed from Philip's actions in building up Macedonian power. Do you think any son of Philip would have done similar things upon inheriting the Macedonian throne? Or was Alexander special? Which aspects of Alexander's deeds simply fulfill the blueprint which had been given to him by Philip, and which of them represent original contributions by Alexander? If you agree with the great man theory of history, I think it's easy to see the careers and effects of Philip and Alexander as proof of its validity, since it seems hard to imagine that Macedonia would ever have risen from such obscurity to such dominance without those 2 men. On the other hand, you could maybe argue that the broader effects that resulted from their actions, such as the fall of the Persian Empire or the spread of Greek culture, were inevitable, and they somehow would have happened whether or not Alexander himself had ever existed. Alexander is one of the more controversial figures in ancient history, and there are no right or wrong answers to these questions. Ancient historians have been vehemently arguing about them for decades. And even the basic personality and goals of Alexander are much debated. And very well argued books can be and have been written which depict him as everything from a blood-crazed, alcoholic, out-of-control teenager to a wise, enlightened ruler who has a universal cultural vision that was ahead of its time. Personally, while I think there are elements of truth at both extremes, I probably incline slightly more to the latter interpretation rather than the former. But I leave it up to you to make up your own minds. In the next lecture, we'll follow Alexander's path to India and catch up on what's been going on there, as well as examining our next 2 great leaders, a grandfather and grandson pair of kings from the Mauryan dynasty. Their names are Chandragupta and Asoka, and as we'll see, they share some intriguing parallels with Philip and Alexander. Thank you.